Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to another edition of The Avid Reader. Today our guest is Megan McLean Ware, author of The Book of Essie, published just last month by Knopf. Megan's memoir, Between Expectations, Lessons from a Pediatric Residency, chronicles her years in training at Boston Medical Center and Boston's Children's Hospital. She still works as a physician and continues to write as well. I don't know how. The Book of Essie is her first novel. Essie is a teenager whose entire life has been documented daily by cameras which record most of her life. Her father and mother, as well as her five siblings, are the stars of a reality show, not unlike the reality shows that are pervasive on our televisions today. Six for Hicks documents the lives of a seemingly shiny, wholesome family centered around the father's gigantic ministry and his flock, and the corollary activities of this ruthless and calculating mother. But all of a sudden, a complication. Essie is pregnant, and by whom? The production team suggests an abortion, which would otherwise be anathema to the ministry and all it stands for, or a pregnancy hidden away and then the baby disposed of to another family. Both options are risky because they could be found out. So marriage is the option they choose for its safety as well as ratings possibilities. Essie, who has a plan of her own in mind, chooses Work Richards, a senior in her high school, a boy who wants out of his situation as much as Essie does. Once the wedding is planned, Essie enlists reporter Liberty Bell, who has her own issues. Then the fun really begins, told in the first person, in alternating paragraphs and chapters, by the three protagonists. We follow along kind of breathless as we weave through this mixture of the Duggars, the Truman Show, and the Hunger Games. It's a great adventure and a kind of morality play, given the political and social situation in which we find ourselves in today's America. So with that, welcome, Megan, and thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
So where in the world did you come up with an idea like this? Because it does, as I said in the introduction, draw from so many different social themes in America today. The idea of being famous for being famous, like the Kardashians or Kate Makes Eight. How did you come about doing it?
Yeah, I mean, it's a great question. Lots of people have been asking me that, although I think you're the first person to loop in the Truman Show. So thank you for that. Now I'll have to go watch that again. I think that people have focused very much on the reality television aspect of the novel, and I think that's really interesting. It adds a lot of layers, and it makes it very timely and very sort of relevant to our existence today on social media, watching these shows. But I think at its heart, this novel grew very much out of my own upbringing. My dad is an Episcopal priest. I grew up in the rectory that was owned by his parish. So it didn't really feel as if it belonged to me. It felt like my room belonged to the church. And I grew up in a very small town in western Massachusetts where at least to me, it felt like everybody knew my name. And so if I was out in public, it felt like everyone was watching and judging and going to report back to my parents if I said something rude or used a bad word. And so my parents had actually moved in with my husband and my daughter and I to help with some of our childcare needs since I was still working as a physician and my husband was busy as well. And I think just being in a household again with them, sort of renegotiating those relationships with my parents now that I was an adult, it just brought back a lot of memories of what it felt like to be under the spotlight like that as a child.
You know, I always like titles and covers. And the title of this book, The Book of Essie, almost sounds like it's biblical, like the Book of Ruth or something like that. And then the cover, the way Essie's face is in profile, it does look, like I said in the introduction, like a morality play. How did you vet the covers? Did you come up with that title? And why is it The Book of Essie?
Yeah, so, I mean, I think The Book of Esther is the actual Bible book, and that was the working title that I used when I was writing the novel. There is a novel, The Book of Ruth, which was popular when I was a child. My grandmother gave me a copy. And if you're looking to draw those parallels between the Bible and the book that Essie ultimately writes in the story, unfortunately, you only have two choices if you have a female protagonist because the Bible is very male heavy. And so I didn't want to redo the Book of Ruth. And I loved the name Essie as a nickname for Esther. It just made her seem so sort of innocent and sweet, but also drew from the great tradition of the Queen of Esther, who's a very strong, particularly wonderful role model. And we made the decision to change it from the Book of Esther because there had been a novel published with that name last year. And we certainly didn't want to infringe on anyone else's wonderful work. And then the cover of the book, we just got so lucky with. Sarah Tour, who's a photographer in, I think, Sweden, took a beautiful portrait of a young woman, and that was Abby Weintraub's inspiration for the cover. She did the cover for Station 11, which was a National Book Finalist Award, National Book Award finalist, and another one of my editor's books. So it sounds like, you know, they've got a good understanding of what each other is looking for. And this is my first novel, so I was just along for the ride, to be honest. There were a series of proposed covers that didn't quite seem to capture it. And then Abby Weintraub came back with this cover, and it's just beautiful. And I think very haunting and sort of evocative. And the sparkles on the cover sort of draw you in. I think they're meant to evoke the sort of television static, but I think it's just shiny and beautiful, and I think it's really been drawing a lot of people in.
Yeah, definitely. You know, in addition to that technical kind of aspect of the book, what made you decide to do, sometimes I don't like the idea of serial chapters told by other characters, but here it worked absolutely perfectly, and what made you decide to do it that way, and then also, again, to talk about it, for them to talk about it themselves in the first person?
Yeah, I mean, I think that I toyed with a lot of different ideas. It seemed natural that the story should be told in the first person because this really is Essie's story. And as I started writing, I had a couple of scenes from which I drew inspiration that were sort of that first kernel of where the story grew from. But it became clear pretty early on that she wasn't going to have access to all of the information that I wanted readers to have access to. And also the relationships between Rourke and Essie and Liberty change so fundamentally from the beginning of the book to the end of the book. At the beginning, they are not inclined to like each other. They don't understand where the other person is coming from. And I thought it would be fascinating to sort of explore that change in perspective, you know, sometimes mid-conversation. But also I really hate when an author is committed to a first-person narrative and finds that they need the character to discover some, you know, pertinent piece of information, and then they're, you know, sneaking around corners and going through other people's desks and sort of doing things very out of character for them in order to bring the reader that little piece of information that they need. So I wanted to sort of have as many narrators as the book required so that you didn't have to play any of those games or jump through any of those hoops, and that you could tell the story the way you needed to tell the story.
You know, it's funny, one of the reviews kind of offhandedly said something like, sometimes you can't tell for a couple minutes which character is talking. Well, of course you can, because the chapters are headed. But,
yeah.
But in any event, I thought that was kind of cool, because for a second you might be tricked. And
yeah.
And I like that. I mean, I think readers like stuff like that, because they like to be challenged. And I thought that was, I don't know if it was purposeful, but I thought that was, helped the book a lot myself.
Yeah, I mean, I think that there were some efforts to sort of make the voices distinct in certain ways that became sort of distracting, and we had to pull back from that.
Yeah.
Because ultimately you've got three characters who are fairly intelligent and are sort of, you know, have this internal narrative that's, you know, probably not going to have a lot of distinction. And I think it was a way to sort of pull out of the story the fact that ultimately, even though they start out in very different places, you know, there's something fundamentally human about the way that they see the world, and that maybe our internal dialogues are not all that different from each other, even if we think that they are. There's sort of that piece of commonality I wanted to draw.
Yeah, well, each of the three of them has their own plan, or if you will, scheme, and they all have their goals and they all have their specific issues, none of which I'm going to use to spoil the book, but
yeah.
But they are those kinds of issues that are life-changing or could be life-changing. And so I think that's why I felt that, okay, who's this coming from? I thought that was good, because it could be coming from anybody, because they each have their own agendas, and those agendas start with something that they might not necessarily be proud of, or they'd like to forget, or they'd like to use to further their careers, lives, whatever. But then again, like my dad used to say, money changes everything.
Mm-hmm.
And it kind of seems to be true in this book, both with the Hicks and with Rourke's parents. And I thought that was interesting, too, because I actually saw a movie last night called First Reformed. And it was about, you know, exactly the same thing you were talking about. It was about, okay, this big church, Abundant Fellowship, is taking all this money from this really rich guy that also happens to be a polluter, a big polluter of the environment. But the money they get, they're using for all kinds of outreach and food for families that would otherwise starve. And the moral dilemma is, you're taking it from the source, but you're doing really good things with it.
Hmm.
And you posited that too, right, in the book?
Yeah, and it's interesting. I've seen the preview for that movie several times, and I've never really been able to figure out what it's about. So,
I know. Well, last night when I saw it, I was thinking to myself, I don't know whether I would ever recommend this movie to anybody, but I think it was good that I saw it. I'd like to hear what you said.
I mean, I think it's just so hard when you're in a situation like that. And, you know, I have had a lot of discussions with my husband over the years, sort of, we are lucky to be in two careers where we can pay the mortgage, put food on the table. But they sometimes pull us in directions that we aren't comfortable with, you know, away from our kids, away from some of our other passions. And I think there's this question of sort of, you know, how much is enough for any family, and sort of how much do you let money dictate your decisions? And I think that, you know, in sort of learning to be a grown-up and learning that actually money is important. You know, when I was little, I was like, I'm going to be a pediatrician, even though pediatricians aren't paid particularly well compared to other doctors, because I love kids and because money doesn't matter. I mean, those words actually came out of my mouth. And now I'm a grown-up and a parent, and, you know, money is not the most important thing, but I have to provide a good life for my kids. That's my job. And so, you know, it was interesting to then put these characters in positions where it's not just, I don't remember exactly what SEA says, it's not just some money, it's, you know, it's a lot of money, and it's a game changer. And to have Rourke sort of realize that his life could be different than the life that he sort of had accepted or envisioned for himself, you know, I think a lot of people sort of, you don't want to think that you would make those decisions, but I think ultimately, you know, there's a number for anyone where you would probably do something uncharacteristic because of the doors it meant that you could unlock.
And that's where I kind of got this. I stretched, but I kind of got the Hunger Games thing out of it, because, you know, it was like Team PETA. You know, it's like Essie kind of was the dynamic force, and Rourke was not, certainly isn't a weak person, but was thrust into this environment. He had no idea what it was. But then when he says the makeup made him feel semi-invulnerable, and Essie brought him to that place, it was almost like that kind of dynamic.
Yeah, and I'm certainly a big Hunger Games fan, gotta say.
Well, so there's a big surprise in the relationship between Essie and Rourke, who do love each other, and it changes the dynamic of the book. And that issue with Rourke, was that something that you spent a great deal of time thinking about? Did it just kind of come full blown into your head, and you decided at the beginning, yeah, this is the way I'm going to structure his life?
Yeah, I mean, I think sort of without giving too much away, you know, Rourke's backstory started out as a way for me to make that arranged marriage less creepy. because I thought that then he would sort of be safe, he would be on her side, and there wouldn't necessarily be these, like, ulterior motives. But then the more that I thought about it, the more that it just seemed natural that, you know, the world is made up of lots of different people, and those people should be the ones that are in books, that your books should represent all of the different people in your life. And so, you know, I think it's important to have a diverse cast of characters, and hopefully it works sort of as a plot point. But also, I think it's just important to sort of have books represent the world around us.
I think when you have, or maybe you already have, talked to book clubs and made your tours and all that, I bet you there'll be people who've said or have said, oh, I wish they could have, you know, it would have been great if they, you know, had this relationship instead of that one. Have they done that?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's funny because people are doing what you're doing. They're being very respectful of the folks in the audience who haven't read it, and everybody's sort of tiptoeing around the issues. But I think that, you know, I think a lot of people really sort of love that the relationship between Essie and Rourke is sort of deep, and it is very loving, and it's a friendship, and you sort of don't get a lot of that. There's a lot of sort of romantic tropes that we follow, and I think it diverges from that in a way that people are finding refreshing. And I think we all need a Rourke or a Liberty in our life, you know, when we're going through things the way Essie's going through.
Yeah, I agree, and I do think it. But because it's steered away from some things, I think, again, the reader was kind of challenged by it. And I, like I said, I always think when you give the reader information that the reader then has to, like, assimilate and then decide whether it's right or wrong, or I like it or I don't like it, I think it's much better than just pacing through a book that you, you know, especially like when the ending and you feel like, yeah, I knew this was coming, or this is a nice way to wrap it up. I think it's much better to leave it open and leave open questions for the reader. But
yeah.
One of the, and that goes to, like, some of the reviewers have felt that there was, that there are, and depending on when you wrote the book, that there's lots of parallels in the book between what's happened in America in the past couple of years, especially politically. But I don't know if you had any of that in mind at all.
Yeah, so, I mean, I love the folks who sort of draw the parallels between the Me Too movement and this book and sort of think of the book as a response to some of that. And it's just so flattering that they would think I could write a book that quickly. The book was actually written in the year leading up to the 2016 presidential election. So there was quite a lot of presidential primaries and debates, and sort of the news cycle was very saturated. And it was becoming clear how polarized this country had become. And so I can't take credit for responding to sort of more recent events, but it certainly did sort of come out of a desire to speak out. And I think that, you know, I have a job where I interact with young people as a pediatrician in an emergency department, and I interact with people sort of all backgrounds and races and, you know, socioeconomic statuses, family education level. Some people love books, some people don't read books. And I think that one of the things that was frustrating to me in my role as a pediatrician is that there are so many issues that fundamentally impact children's health that I can do nothing to address from my role inside the exam room, inside the hospital. And that there are these bigger issues that we as a society need to face head on. And so that was my goal in writing the book, was to sort of respond to some of those frustrations that I've been having, give a voice to some of that. And it was a way to advocate for my patients sort of outside of the normal patient-doctor interaction.
Well, it's funny because you said young people, and then you talked about your patients who are young. When you wrote this, did you have an idea in your mind that your audience was going to be or should be or ought to be young people, that it would resonate more with young people than others? Because it's gotten so much buzz from so many different places, and, you know, probably will be optioned if it hasn't already been optioned as a movie because it's very cinematic. But did you have in mind a specific reader, you know, like a younger reader?
Yeah, I mean, it's a great question. My publisher is an adult publisher, and so they are marketing this as literary fiction, which is a marketing decision on their part. But I do think it has a lot of crossover with the YA market.
Yeah.
And I have to say, you know, Knopf has been incredibly, incredibly supportive and lovely. So I wouldn't want to work with anyone else on this book. But I do think we have to acknowledge that the two protagonists are on the younger side, and that it could also, you know, my hope is that it doesn't not appeal to grownups, but that it appeals to everyone. And I wrote it in part after having this experience where all of these young people, just to circle back, were coming into the emergency department reading The Hunger Games. And I was trying to be cool because I have watched all the Disney movies and I know all the Disney songs, and I absolutely do sing them to my patients when I'm like sewing up their cuts. But that only works for the younger kids. And so I was trying to like be cool, and I thought, oh, I'll read The Hunger Games and then I'll have something to talk about with these teenage patients. And so I read it. I loved it. Suzanne Collins is lovely and wonderful. But then anytime I would try to talk to teenager patients about The Hunger Games, there was that teenage eye roll that you get. And it became clear that they thought I was encroaching on something that belonged to them. And they would humor me and talk to me, but like it was clear they did not think I could actually understand Katniss or Peeta or Gale in the way that they did. And so it got me thinking about sort of who stories belong to, because I was a precocious reader as a young person and read a lot of my parents' books. And I got that same eye roll from them in the opposite direction, that like, oh, you'll understand this book better when you get older. I got that about The Handmaid's Tale a lot. And I have, you know, my understanding of the book has changed over the years, but, you know, it was precious to me even then. And so my goal in writing Essie was to write a story that I hoped would appeal equally to grownups and to older teenagers, and that we could have this, you know, read by parents and read by their children and then discussed at the dinner table, and sort of use it as a jumping off point to have really important discussions about, you know, bigotry, about, you know, standing up for people who have suffered unspeakable acts, and that maybe it could be a conduit to having some of those conversations that are difficult, but that families and communities and friends need to have.
That's funny. Now that I think about it, when I interviewed Ransom Riggs about Miss Peregrine's Home for Peculiar Children, we talked about the same thing, and he said, because I have an independent bookstore, and we were talking about, he was actually saying, I don't know where it should go.
Yeah.
And then I realize now I interviewed Emily Mandel for Station 11, and we had exactly the same conversation, too. Bottom line is, if you're reading, it doesn't really make much difference who you are as long as you're reading, at least as I would say as the owner of a bookshop. But so changing.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
No, I mean, it's just interesting because, like, you know, obviously there is a lot that goes on the scene, on behind the scenes to market and develop and sort of put together a publicity campaign for a book. But as an author, you know, I just want people to read it. And I don't care who's reading it, as long as it's reaching as many people as possible, as long as people are sort of spreading the word to their friends. Because I think, you know, for me, at least growing up, talking about books was a very, you know, it was the same for me as I think people being on Facebook is today. Like interacting with people and sort of having that common ground of having read the same book and responded to the same book. Now we do that with memes or, you know, with like pictures of each other's babies. But we should do it about books. That's what books are for.
Well, going on with that, if we talk about kids, another also challenging thing for the reader is, do you think that Essie's mother, behind the makeup, behind the iron persona, do you think, one, she actually loves Essie? And in a much more maybe serious and mysterious way, do you think the same of her father?
Yeah, I mean, so when my parents first read the first draft of the novel, My mom's first response to me was, "Oh God, please tell me I'm not this woman." because Celia's awful. You know, I mean, there's no way around it. She's pretty horrible. And Essie's dad does have more in common with my dad, just that, you know, he's so devoted to his ministry and sort of the intellectual process of thinking about theology and trying to translate that into the real world, that he misses things, you know, that are happening right in front of his face. And he's maybe a little bit more detached. But I think that they both, you know, in my head came from a place that sort of explains their background and explains their motivations, that, you know, they started out with good intentions, right? That they are devout Christians, and that in and of itself for them, you know, is a relationship of love with God and of wanting to share his word. And then it sort of over the years and over time gets like bastardized and sort of mutates into something that's, you know, less appealing if you look at it from the outside, and can get turned into something pretty nasty. But I think, you know, sort of fundamentally, they still have that core of humanity, that little, you know, piece of them inside. But I think it's sort of been warped over time.
What insight did you have, if any, going towards the way their lives became somewhat distasteful, at least to certain people? What insight, if any, did you have into how these shows are made? Or did you research any aspect of it? Or did you just figure it out yourself?
Yeah, I mean, I think that part of the answer is that it's fiction, so I certainly took liberties. I have a friend from high school who worked for many years as a producer on The Bachelor, and so I could get some sort of, you know, feedback from her, and just sort of understand that it's a business, right? That there's a lot of people behind the scenes. I think that's what I took from my relationship with her, this sense that, like, there's the people who are on the show, but then there's this huge sort of machinery behind them driving everything. And then specifically sort of in my own reality show, like perusing, I just was really interested early on in the John and Kate Plus Eight, just because those kids were so young, and as a pediatrician and as like now a mother, you kind of just sort of have to wonder, you know, did they consent really to that level of exposure and that degree of invasion of their privacy? Sort of what was asked of them, and are they qualified to consent if you're like a toddler, to being on TV, and sort of all of the impact that that's having on their lives now and had on it then. Where are those trade-offs? And, you know, and we, how do we make those decisions for our own kids when we're posting things online and on the internet? And so I really saw the reality show in the novel as an extension of all of our relationships with social media, because, you know, Essie's different. She certainly lived a life far beyond the level of scrutiny that I think any of us have had to endure. But it's just a difference in the matter of degree. We all have that level of scrutiny at moments in our lives, and we, you know, put ourselves out there.
Yeah, one of the things that was good and was brought out early on was Essie's mostly absent from the book sister, how she and Essie discovered a way that they could kind of listen in on the what was going on, which again goes back to the Truman Show, and how they could kind of eavesdrop on their own world. And that was something special too, I think, early on.
Yeah, I mean, they do it through this grate in the wall, but I remember doing that through the banister and the staircase in my house, right? Like, that there are always adult conversations that the kids are not necessarily privy to. And in my family, you know, they were sort of run-of-the-mill, boring stuff. But in hers, they sort of take on this otherworldly aspect.
Yeah, when I was a kid, my brother and I used to stay at the top, especially when there are parties. Because when there are parties, you really learned a lot, especially when there was drinking involved. We we really love doing that. And also because I'm kind of weird, I used to have this feeling, or in dreams too, that when I wasn't there, the whole universe was kind of packed up and put away. And then when I came, when I woke up in the morning, they had to really quickly put it all back together again. You know, because since I wasn't there in my solipsistic thinking, the universe wasn't really necessary at that point.
Yeah, that's awesome. I remember the gentleman who wrote Sophie's Choice, is it William Styron?
Yeah.
His daughter wrote a great book about sort of growing up as his daughter. And I heard her on NPR at some point, and her description of just sort of being under the table at these dinner parties where her dad would be entertaining sort of the elite of sort of intellectual society and literary society and sort of all of the things that she got to eavesdrop on. And I just remember thinking, oh man, the stuff that I thought I was getting good gossip when I was young, but she really was getting good gossip. She was sort of in the thick of it.
Yeah, that would have been great. Well, I think it would have been great. I'm not quite sure it always would have been, because of course he was a very depressed person too. So, yeah, and he wrote a book, I think. What did he write? I think it was called Darkness or something, about his depression. But yeah, so, and also the other question I thought about was how you brought Cuba into it. And I thought, I bet you she's gone to Cuba because you really seem to understand the country. And I wondered why else you would bring it in.
It has certainly been in the news, you know, sort of breaking down barriers, people being able to travel there. I was lucky enough to travel there in medical school back before, like, you could go without, like, a special visa. And I went down for a conference, and Paul Farmer, who's very prominent in the international health community, was speaking at the conference. The hotel that Essie and Warwick stay at is the hotel that hosted the conference. And I was poor, and so I stayed at the cheap hotel a couple of blocks away. And so I think it was primarily in the book because I was so, you know, jealous that other people had chosen to stay in this hotel, which is beautiful and lovely. And I was sort of in this awful room a couple blocks away with no air conditioning. So I think it was just really mostly a chance to get a do-over. But because, you know, I think that Cuba is going to be an interesting place. It'll be fascinating to see how things develop as more people travel. Because I think, you know, we all travel to that part of the Caribbean. And, you know, sort of there's this resort mentality, and you expect things to be very Americanized. I certainly experienced that taking my kids places to Jamaica, to the Dominican Republic. And sort of, you know, you question what culture is lost when such a large segment of the population is sort of catering to Americans. And Cuba at least has been a little bit insulated from that and has just a fascinating culture. And it'll just be really interesting to see what changes over time.
Yeah. Well, so lastly, the other really fine thing I felt about the book was at the end, the reader can kind of extrapolate out what happens to Essie and Rourke and their friends, his friends, and also what happens to all the rest of them, because, you know, what happens to the show, what happens to the other children, what happens to Essie's sister. So one of the things I really liked about the book was you left it so that the reader could kind of create his or her own sequels in their mind. But in any event, I really liked the book. It'll be on the front table. Oh, actually, it already is on the front table at our bookstore, and I look forward to talking to you again when you write your next one. And I was just going to say, if it hasn't been optioned for a movie, and I don't know, I certainly think it will be, don't you?
I think it would be really fun for readers to sort of see it translated into some sort of television or screen, and, you know, just fun for me to sort of learn about how those things work and happen. I think the most fun thing about this experience has just been sort of interacting with all of the different people who love books and love stories and love storytelling. And, you know, some of them are editors and some of them are publicists or marketers. And there's just this whole world of, like, this army of people who are, like, marching to bring stories out into the world. And it's wonderful to be a part of that.
Well, thank you very much for bringing us this story. It was a great one. So, and thank you so much. And thanks for joining us today.
Thank you. Have a wonderful day.
You too. We were talking with Megan McLean Weir. Her book is The Book of Essie. And as I said at the outset, it's a book about kind of like a reality show, but it also involves a relationship between a guy and a girl. And, you know, it just, and it all, and it also, like I said, involves this feeling of The Hunger Games and The Truman Show and Kate Makes Eight, all jumbled together in a really nice way. And it can be read by young adults. It can be read by adults. And it almost could be understood by kids who are in their teens or tweens. So in any event, I highly recommend it. And it's gotten a lot of buzz, and I think it probably will be picked up and optioned for a movie. So we got a lot of good stuff coming up. We have Rebecca Mackay, who's going to talk about her latest novel, The Great Believers, and journalist and author Zachary Wood, who's only 21 years old, is going to discuss his anticipated debut memoir, which is called Uncensored, My Life and Uncomfortable Conversations at the Intersection of Black and White America. It's an amazing tour de force by a guy who's just basically just graduated college. So for a complete schedule, as always, you can visit us at Wellington Square Books or just simply download our podcast, go to iTunes, and type in the name of the book, name of the author, or just The Avid Reader. So thanks very much, and we look forward to having you with us next week here on The Avid Reader.